So the objective of the last couple of lectures were kind of abstract. From now on, we're going to get much more into concrete matters. So for the next few lectures, we're going to try to compute the spectrum of strings. More precisely, we're going to consider this bosonic string theory, which we introduced yesterday, with an action, which was with a worksheet action. Which was just quadratic and free. We're going to try to figure out what is the spectrum of this string theory, meaning if I have a string that is propagating by itself through space-time, what sort of excitations does it have? Which sort of states does it have? Which sort of states can I insert later on inside my scattering amplitudes? Okay, so essentially we're going to study this action on a worksheet, which corresponds to just a string propagating in time, which is a cylinder. Now, in particular, because this action just describes a bunch of free scalars on the worksheet, one for each space-time dimension, we're just going to focus on studying a theory of a free scalar field on a cylinder. So today, that's the topic. The free scalar, two-dimensional scalar field living on a cylinder, on a cylindrical worksheet. This is, you might think this is a very simple theory. After all, it's a free theory. But it turns out to have to be a surprisingly rich topic. So to be concrete, let me put some coordinates on this cylinder instead of this, just this U1 and U2. I'm going to denote space as sigma on the worksheet and time. Well, I'm going to, for simplicity today, I'm going to consider a Euclidean worksheet. So I have a Euclidean time tau. And you should remember that Euclidean time is related to the usual time in the following way. So it turns out that in order to for most purposes, you can just consider Euclidean worksheets, even if they're propagating into a Lorentzian spacetime. It turns out there is nothing to gain in trying to make the worksheet itself Lorentzian. Although sometimes to dealing with issues like I epsilon prescriptions in quantum field theory, issues analogous to I epsilon prescription in quantum field theory, it's useful to sort of analytically continue away a bit away from the Euclidean worksheet. There are some nice recent papers by Witten on the topic, but nothing that we need to concern ourselves with. So my space coordinate is going to be periodic because I want a cylinder. I'll take the periodicity to be L. Now, because we have wild symmetry, we can always rescale the metric on the worksheet. We could always imagine changing L by well transformation. But for the time being, it's useful to keep track of it. It helps understanding what's going on. And then later on, we can just set it to 1. In a sense, yeah, anyway.
Is the whole discussion based on the
equal? No, I'm just studying a single scalar field for now. So there will be some field X sigma tau, which sort of lives in the real numbers. Okay? Well, which in Lorentzian signature lives in the real numbers. And then Euclidean signature, there is an analytic continuation. Then when you want to study the string moving in 26 dimensions, you're going to get one of the scalar fields for every, you're going to get 26 copies of this, roughly. The time direction is marginally different, but not much. Okay. So when you study free quantum field theory, is usually useful to use Fourier transform in flat space. It's usually useful to do Fourier transform, so to just expand this field in Fourier modes. So if you study a classical scalar field with this action, the classical solutions will look like this. Let me explain clearly what I did. So I took my field, I expanded in Fourier series in sigma. Sigma is a compact direction, so this is the usual Fourier series for a compact direction on a circle, for a function on a circle. And then I introduced the time dependence from using the equations of motion. Now, as you're probably familiar with when you quantize a free theory, the modes of this field will behave essentially like the modes of individual harmonic oscillators. So you can write commutation relations which turn out to take this form. We're going to check that this is sensible in a moment. And then there's this sort of zero modes, X, which describes the center of mass of the string, and P, which is the speed of the center of mass of the string, behaves just like position and momentum of a particle. OK, other questions? Apart from some minor notational issues, this should be just the same as you saw when you quantize the free scalar in some general number of dimensions. The particular number I've been labeling, the particular way I've been labeling the modes with AENs and A bar Ns is just convenient for the purpose of two-dimensional field theory. And we'll understand why I'm using these notations momentarily. If you want to really make sure that this convention, that this makes sense, I invite you to compute the equal time commutator
with X0,
are they all independent? These are all independent modes. So these are the non-zero commutation relations. Every other commutation relation you can write has zero on the right-hand side. So A is commuted X, A is commuted P, A is with different, with indices which don't sum to zero, commute among each other. And if you use these rules, you plug them in here, you verify that this is the correct quantization for this for the free scalar, right? The position and momentum at each point in space commute in different points in space commute, and at the same point, they don't.
In case of the Euclidean time tau, it has a range from minus infinity to infinity.
That's correct.
But sigma is bounded by 0 to L. Then how, yeah, 0 to 2 pi L, then how can we do the expand in Fourier series with same basis?
Like no, see, as I said, I expanded in Fourier series in sigma, and then I imposed the equation of motion to find the time dependence. If I was working in a Schrödinger picture, then I would just not put any time dependence in here. Right, and I would have written down some Schrodinger equation for my states. Here I'm working in Heisenberg picture, so I put the time dependence in the fields. But yes, it would probably be better to think about A's and N's as the A's. So perhaps I should have done one extra step. I should have said, okay, let me take X at time 0 and dx at time 0, Fourier expanded in sigma, impose this, and then derive this. That would have been probably a better way to do it. I'm taking a little bit of a shortcut here. Okay, so what is the Hilbert space of this system? So if you look at this picture, at the expression, you can recognize which modes have positive energy and which modes have negative energy. I picked my conventions in such a way that the modes with positive index actually lower the energy of a state. So in these conventions, I'll have some ground state. Like in an harmonic oscillator, this ground state is going to be killed by all the modes that lower the energy. And then I can build up from it using modes that raise the energy. The only exception is I need to figure out what's going on with these modes. But I'm going to treat them just as the modes of a particle. So I'll have a ground state for each choice of momentum, a ground state for the oscillators for each choice of momentum. And then on top of this, I'm going to build a tower of states. Et cetera, et cetera. I'm organizing the states based on their energy. We'll compute the energy of the states momentarily, but for now, let's just say that this had some energy, which we'll compute. This has 1 over L more energy, or yes, this has 2 over L more energy, and so on.
In quantum field theory, we have usually a unique ground state.
Mm-hmm.
And react with some operators to generate momentum eigenstates. But now we have the momentum eigenstates to be the ground state. Could you explain where the difference comes from?
Well, the main difference is that usually you think about massive quantum field theory. If you're studying a free scalar in any number of dimensions in a compact space, then the zero mode would still be a dynamical field, and you would have a ground state for each momentum or the zero mode. On the other hand, if you consider a non-compact space-time, then the zero mode of the field is not something that you are free to, that is free to fluctuate. It's fixed by boundary conditions at infinity. And in that case, you just don't consider a conjugate momentum to it. It's not normalizable. There is no normalizable operator. So the difference, as you see from the usual quantum field theory intuition, comes from the fact that I have a compact space, that the scalar field is living on the circle.
So all the p's have the same energy?
No. So we'll compute the energy of this piece in a moment.
Is the creation of an annihilation like an and a minus n?
Well, the positive, the things with positive index are annihilation. The things with negative index are creation. Also, the energy you can guess what's the energy of this state, but anyway. as I said, it will compute it in a moment. So before we discussed the energy when we studied the stress tensor of this theory. Before that, I would like to study some other conserved quantities. See, a free scalar theory has in particular a symmetry, which is a symmetry under translations of in field space. The action I wrote is invariant under the transformation x goes to x plus some shift, okay, independent of the position. So every symmetry should be accompanied by a current. Okay. So the current is essentially the gradient of x. It's actually useful to normalize it with an I here. So, I mean, again, I invite you to apply the Noether theorem to this action and this symmetry, and write that this is the current. But you should be able to see that this is conserved. Why? What are the equations of motion for the scalar field? They are just dA, dAx equal to zero. That means the divergence of this current vanishes. Okay. Now, it's useful to use complex coordinates in everything that everything we do. As I mentioned yesterday, they make a lot of things like quasi-symmetry easier to deal with. And they're just very convenient in two dimensions. So I'm going to define the complex coordinate S equal to tau minus I sigma. Okay, so let me look at a component of the current along the S, this complex S direction. If you look at that expression over there, you see that these modes only depend on S, while these ones depend on S bar. So you get something like this. So first of all, this shows you quite clearly that this is indeed the current for translations. We said that P was the momentum conjugate to the zero mode, to the zero mode of the field. So P is is the object which shifts x and then shifts the whole field. And if I let me just write same expression here if I continue. Okay. If you write something like the contour integral of JA the UA, or say of J sigma the sigma, over sigma equal to zero to 2 pi L. Well, J tau, the sigma, you are going to get essentially 4 pi P. Okay? So this shows you the conserved current associated to the conserved quantity associated to this current is indeed the momentum of the string. And verifies that definition was sensible. Okay, so notice that this part of the current is holomorphic, completely holomorphic, only depends on S. And this part is anti-holomorphic. That means that the current conservation law, which you could write like this, actually breaks down into two separate equations which hold separately. So exact, in this case, it's actually true that the holomorphic and anti-holomorphic part of the currents are separately conserved. This is a very important fact, absolutely crucial. It means that this theory has more symmetry than you would actually think. You don't just have this translation symmetry, there are some other hidden symmetries. Actually, yes?
Do we allow X to be complex
at this point? As I said, the reality conditions in Euclidean space-time are always a little bit tricky. So the correct way to do things is that you impose the reality conditions in Lorentzian time, space-time, in Lorentzian coordinates, and then you analytically continue. So this X does not look real. But if you replace tau with IT, it becomes real. This manifests itself in many different ways. For example, when you study quantum field theories in Lorentzian space-time, there is the notion of unitarity, which essentially means the inner product, you know, the norm of states is positive. When you go to Euclidean signature, unitarity is replaced by something called reflection positivity, which is not quite the same when you write down the formula. Or, you know, when people study fermions in Lorentzian in Euclidean signature, tend to get very confused because they have some reality conditions in mind in Lorentzian signature, and they try to make them hold in Euclidean signature, and it doesn't work. Euclidean signature, everything has to be analytically continued in an appropriate way. So, for example, in a lot of situations when you have a fermion, it is Majorana in Lorentzian space-time. In Euclidean space-time, you need to consider a complex object, an holomorphic object, without having the complex conjugate in the action at all. Which?
Even if you make a replacement R equals IT, don't you need some relation amongst the Fourier coefficients for X to be real?
Sorry.
They can't be independent.
As I said, the A's with positive and negative index are raising and lowering operators. So in Lorentzian signature, they are Hermitian conjugate. So they are Hermitian conjugate. So in Lorentzian signature, you put an equal to a minus n dagger, and then these expressions will become real.
So a bar become a dagger?
A minus n becomes a n dagger. So the bar here only refers to the fact that these modes appear in front of holomorphic or anti-holomorphic things. It does not refer to conjugation in Lorentzian signature. In Lorentzian signature, these are left movers and these are right movers, both real and independent. So these modes in Lorentzian signature are modes that move to the left. These modes are modes that move to the right. Completely unrelated. Yeah, it takes a bit to get used to it. I personally got hopelessly confused when I was writing these notes a couple of years ago. So back here, what I wanted to say is that you don't only have these equations, but because you can even write equations like this. So we don't just get one conservation equation. We're getting infinitely many conservation equations. For every holomorphic function, I get a new conservation law. This corresponds to symmetries where you're shifting your field by an holomorphic function or by an anti-holomorphic function. I mean, this is true in general for free theories, that they have a lot of hidden symmetries. But in two dimensions, it's particularly neat. OK. Now, just for a matter of notation, because of these expressions, it's actually convenient to define A0 just as minus A0 bar equal to P. OK, it's just a conventional notation. It makes some formula a bit shorter. OK. Now, for future reference, we'll need one more piece of information about this current. We'll need a two-point function computed on the vacuum. Now, to be really, really honest, these ground states should be delta function normalizable. Okay, because just for as it happens for a free particle. When I write an expression like this, I should really put a P and a P prime and a delta P minus P prime. I will leave the delta P minus P prime always implicit to avoid writing any uselessly long expressions. So I write the expression first, and then I'll show you how can you derive it. As you see, having this L, carrying along this L is quite unpleasant, but I really want to keep it for now. OK, so the way you treat these states and you compute inner products is the same as you learn with harmonic oscillator. So for example, if you want the inner product of P with A minus 1 P prime, it will be 0, because A minus 1 actually annihilates the bra. If I have something like P A1, and you want to contract it with the A minus 1 P prime, well, I'm going to commute A1 across A minus 1, get 1. So on and so forth. So you can just take this expression, actually this expression, plug it in here, expand, and then just do the sum with the symmetric series. And you get here. It's very easy to write the formula with generic momentum here. You're essentially just going to get an extra p square term. OK. Now, so this is a particularly simple example with this concert current for shift symmetry of the scalar field. Next, I want to look at a more interesting concert current, which is the stress tensor. So the stress tensor is the concert current associated to translations in space and time and rotations. But it's actually because we started with a generic metric anyway in our considerations, it's better to think about the stress tensor in terms of a variation of the action with respect to the metric. So classically, the stress tensor is best defined as the variation of the action with respect to the two-dimensional metric. Okay. So if you put the metric back there, compute the variation, and then set the metric to be flat, you get some naive expression for the scalar field, which is just in complex coordinates. And I heard that you've done some conformal field theory, so presumably these expressions will not be new to you. Okay, so I denote typically the SS component of T is just the stress tensor just denoted as T, and the S bar component is just denoted as S bar, as T bar, and the SS bar component is zero. Now, in general, the properties of the stress tensor depend on the symmetries of your theory. For example, if the theory is invariant under diffeomorphisms, it means that the action doesn't change when you do it when you change the metric and the field in a specific way, and that implies the conservation law is diff-invariant. Similarly, if you have wild invariance, it means that the action doesn't change when you rescale the metric. And that shows you that TAA must be zero. The stress tensor should be traceless. The trace of the stress tensor in complex coordinates is TSS bar, and that's why it's zero. So classically, the scalar field theory is wild invariant. Now, quantum mechanically, we need to give a meaning to this expressions. We need to define the stress tensor as a quantum mechanical operator, multiplying fields at the same location in space is not a terribly good idea in quantum mechanics, so we need some regularization. Notice that in quantum mechanics, the right way to think about the stress tensor is that the variation of some of the path integral with respect to the variation of a metric is given by the stress tensor. That means the stress tensor keeps track of the variation of the action, but also the variation of the measure as you vary the metric. So when you give a definition of the stress tensor, quantum mechanically, what you're doing is you're at the same time also telling me how you're going to regulate the measure for metrics that are close to your initial metric. So defining the stress tensor properly implicitly tells you how you are regulating the theory in the neighborhood of a given metric. This is just to say that, in particular, the anomalies, like things like the Weyl anomaly we were discussing yesterday, would manifest themselves into properties of the regularized stress tensor.
You mean like if Weyl anomaly exists, then TSS bar may not be zero?
That's right. Now, it just so happened that the value of TSS bar is a function of the metric itself, which vanishes when the metric is flat. So at the leading order, if you're varying a flat metric, you don't see things there. Because we're studying the scalar field in flat, on a flat cylinder, you don't see the Weyl anomaly directly as something here. But the various components of the stress tensor are related by the conservation law. And furthermore, the various components of the stress tensor tell you how certain symmetries act. So essentially, what happens is that the Weyl anomaly pops out in other places of the calculation, can be seen also from properties of T and D bar. But I'll discuss it momentarily. It is a good exercise to figure out what was here for a generic metric.
Your second definition of the T, I mean, stress tensor seems very different from the original definition of variation of actual stress metric. Like, I mean, we have to deal with the measure, as you mentioned, then.
What happens here when I vary things? Remember, there is a 1 over h bar, right? And I probably should put a 1 over h bar here. So the leading ordered variation comes purely from the variation of the action. The variation of the metric, or the measure, manifests itself into one loop effects, into the regularization of your stress tensor. So how do we regularize this expression? But there are various ways to do that. But point splitting is typically an excellent choice, if you want to be precise. So we're going to define the stress tensor this way, as a limit. I should put a hat to make sure that this is an operator, but I would just ignore hat for now. I let the context decide if this was a classical or a quantum expression. Okay, so what did I do? I took my fields and I split them in space-time. I put them at slightly different points. And then I tried to bring them together. Now, because this is a quantum field theory, there are singularities when you bring the fields together. For example, if you were in a flat space, the singularity would be given precisely by the correlation function of two currents, which is minus 1 over s minus s prime squared. Now, on a cylinder, I showed you there that I computed the correlation function to show you this what kind of divergence you have. As you see, that the correlation function is somewhat more complicated, but if you expand that expression as s approaches s prime, you'll find precisely this divergence. Now, you might wonder, why don't I just subtract that instead of this? How do I pick what should I subtract in the definition? Well, I'm trying to define a local quantum field theory, so my prescription better be local. It can only depend on what's going on at the point or in the neighborhood of the point. Particularly, my definition cannot depend on L, cannot depend on the side of the cylinder. This punchline is the only reason I kept L all the way there. So this is pretty much the only natural choice. If I were in a generic space-time with a generic metric, I would probably use a similar definition where I subtract off something like 1 over the distance squared, okay, between the two points. That way I get a nice diffeomorphism invariant definition of the stress tensor. So I invite you as an exercise to do precisely that. So you take the classical expression of the stress tensor in a generic metric, point split it, subtract 1 over distance, plus subtract the divergence, so add 1 over distance squared. roughly, something like that, and then check what happens to TSS bar. Making sure that every step the stress sensor remains conserved. So you'll find that if you want TSS bar to be zero, you'll have to break diffeomorphism invariance. If you want to keep diffeomorphism invariant, you'll find something on the right-hand side there, proportional to the curvature. So I'm not going to do that exercise here because we don't have much time and our focus is this scalar field in a flat cylinder. But if you want to really get to grips with quantum field theory, that's a good exercise. OK. Now, there is another way to write this expression on the cylinder. I can try to compare it with normal ordering. Remember, normal ordering is the prescription where you subtract the two-point function, pretty much. Subtract the expectation value, the weak contraction of the fields. So if you do this, you need to compare the difference between this and that expression over there. Because when you do normal ordering, you're going to subtract that instead of this. So if I want to write something like this, where the normal ordering is done on the cylinder, then I need to add to this the difference between this and that as s goes to s prime, which turns out to be non-zero. Is actually minus 1 over 24 L squared. OK. So this is the Casimir energy. So.
Oh, sorry. So when you add a counter term like that, are you implicitly saying that you're renormalizing at some energy scale? That's the justification.
No, see, I'm not thinking about the stress tensor as generator of translations. But I have to think about the stress tensor is variation with respect to the metric. I want to say it properly. I have a limited, if I want my stress tensor to be conserved, Lorentz invariant, and local, I have this cuts down quite a bit on my freedom to choose counterterms. So for example, if I just think about the stress tensor as the conserved as something that measures the energy, I might think, okay, I can pick the energies, the zero, the energy, whatever I want. But that will typically not be compatible with the choice of Lorentz invariance, locality.
When you add a counterterm to a quantum field theory, doesn't that usually correspond to some renormalization scale at which you have to make a measurement?
Well, not in this context. In a sense, saying picking the regularization for the stress tensor, let me say this. In general, quantum field theory, when you define your local operators, you need some renormalization. You're renormalizing things so that these operators put inside a correlation function are finite. And you try to make your choice in the way that these operators are local operators, because one of the most important properties of quantum field theory is locality, and you don't want to break that. This does not So here I was starting from a free field theory. I'm trying to define operators in a free field theory. There are no interactions. So I don't encounter problems with picking an energy scale.
But I mean, this in, taking the points together, they correspond to some like UV divergence, right?
Mm-hmm.
In the momentum space. So
yes.
If I remember correctly, the justification for adding the count term.
I'm not adding a counter term to the action.
Okay.
So the normalization is the same. The same word is used for many different things. So normalization might mean modifying my, fixing the definition of my theory so that that is well defined. But it also means renormalize, fixing the definition of the operators, the observables I put in the theory. So this is the renormalization of a local operator. It's not the renormalization of the action of the theory.
Okay, but in principle, mm-hmm. The components of T should be, are observables, right?
Yes.
And so what if you just added a counter term like 2 over s minus s bar or s prime squared, then
mm-hmm.
it seems like there's some arbitrariness in here.
Well, if you pick something that has a different divergence, this will not give me a finite quantity when I insert it in the correlation function. Whatever I pick here has to cancel the divergence that occurs when I take this limit
right.
as the points coincide. Now, you could say, okay, why don't I add 1?
Yeah.
Sure, but whatever you add has to be Lorentz invariant, has to be local. So you're free to add, for example, a cosmological constant, say. You can say, OK, I take my TAB, I take your definition and add to it a multiple of delta AB. That's fine. You can surely do so. That's going to modify TSS bar, not TSS. And you wanted a theory which has scale invariance, so presumably that will fix the choice of not having 1 here to have 0. But also, what adding a constant to TSS bar is not going to change the properties of T that what we're studying now. What you cannot do if you want a local theory is to put something here that depends on the global geometry of space-time. That depends on what you're doing far away. You cannot change your rule depending on what you're doing over there. So this is the correct way to derive this 1 over 24. There are shortcuts that you can use to derive this 1 over 24, zeta function regularization or whatnot. Those are shortcuts which, in the worst case scenario, they're just formal mathematical manipulations that might have nothing to do with the physics. They might just give you the wrong answer. The reason they give you the right answer is actually pretty subtle. There was a nice blog post by Terence Tao on the subject some couple of years ago, which I think is still available. So in the textbooks, usually you find zeta function regularization to compute things like the Casimir energy because they don't have because they don't feel like defining a stress tensor and going through all the steps. But the correct physical way to do it is to fix things like Casimir energy is I want a stress tensor which is local and conserved. Once I find it, it's uniquely determined, and I read off what the Casimir energy is.
Mm-hmm.
No infinities are harmed in this calculation.
For T, T is a physical quantity, and that like normal operators are what we're
mm-hmm.
supposed to put in when we calculate?
No, so the reason you write in terms of normal order things is that normal order things have zero expectation value by definition.
Uh-huh.
So if you're asking yourself, what is the energy of the vacuum? Well, you compute the expectation value of T. This vanishes because it's a normal order, and you're left with the Casimir energy. So this measures the energy of the vacuum. This measures the energy of excitations you have put on top of your vacuum.
But then that would depend on the definition of your T. Like in the, because you define T in this way, so...
But I have no choice.
Oh.
This is the only way I could define T, which would be conserved local.
So the way you define the quantum is using diffeomorphism and also locality.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
That's correct.
How do we
Actually, here I just use locality, nothing, pretty much.
How do we define the zero of the energy in this whole framework? I mean, there is a minus sign, so it looks not so comfortable. Like, how we define, like, and what we can measure is the difference of energy. So,
no, what we can measure is the correlation function of the stress tensor. For example, the stress tensor is well defined. Notice that if you added the cosmological constant, it would also contribute to the energy, because when you compute the energy, you're integrating E, you're integrating T tau tau over space. T tau tau is the sum of T, T bar, and T SS bar. So it's true that if you allow yourself to add a cosmological constant, you can change the value of the energy of the vacuum. That's definitely the case. We are working in conventions where the theory is scale invariant. So the TSS bar, at least in flat space, is zero. The detector sort of gives you the zero of the energy. The zero energy is the energy of flat, infinite space. And then if you make your space compact, your energy is not zero. Another way to say it is if I take this cylinder and I cut it like that, then the energy of that I measure in this direction will be zero. But I cut it like this, and I get the Casimir energy. OK, so from now on, I just set L equal to 1 because that was all I needed L for. And the reason I went to this is, as I said, I really dislike when people say, OK, let's compute the energy of the vacuum, and let's use zeta function regularization. You get, you know, sum over n from 1 to infinity. Let's use zeta function regularization. That's minus 124. That must be the right answer. It's a bit too fast. Now, T is built out of something holomorphic. It will still be holomorphic.
Sorry. So this picture from yesterday, where you take the large, you limit the tubes are turning into lines.
Mm-hmm.
That corresponds to taking the length of the string to be zero? Or did that shrink a string to a point?
Well, if you want, it corresponds to looking at energies which are much lower than the gap between these two, between these ground states and this. See, if you look at very low energies, you don't excite the string, it looks like just a free particle. Or the excited states look like very massive particles. But these are still not the states of the string. Okay? Here I'm just studying the states of one free scalar on the circle. In order to understand the states of the string, we'll have to first of all put on 26 scalars. That's easy. But then we have, more importantly, to keep taking into account of the equations for the metric, the constraint. So we gauge the way the metric, but that doesn't mean that the equation of motion of the metric are gone away, have gone.
Is there a nice physical intuition of why the Casimir energy is diverging as L goes to zero?
Well, hell has no meaning. It's a one invariant.
But it's also like the length of the string, right?
No, L is no. L is the, as I said, L is not the length of the string in space-time. L is an arbitrary size we assign to the worksheet. We wanted to put coordinates on the worksheet. We picked L was our choice of gauge. It's a pure gauge quantity. Okay. So I wanted to just write down the so in your stress tensor, it's holomorphic, and it's conventional to expand it in this form. So by plugging this expression in here, you can read off the expression for these modes. So these are called the Virasoro generators. They are the Fourier modes, so the stress tensor. There are some holomorphic modes and then some anti-holomorphic modes associated to T bar. Now here holds the same principle that we discussed here. The stress tensor usually is just a conserved quantity for translations. But the conservation law for the stress tensor actually breaks down into pieces here, because T and T bar are separately conserved. This is holomorphic. This is anti-holomorphic. Furthermore, I can take T multiplied by any holomorphic function, and it remains conserved. So this is the phenomenon that in two-dimensional quantum field theories, the form of scale invariant, one invariance really, and the form of phase invariant becomes conformal symmetry. And conformal symmetry is an infinite dimensional symmetry in two dimensions. So we said yesterday that this setup is in general invariant under any holomorphic transformation of the fields. The action of a free scalar is invariant if you take your complex coordinate and do an arbitrary holomorphic redefinition of it. This is a sort of an infinite generalization of translations. And the conserved quantities are all the modes of the stress tensor. And they will play an important role for us, because the equations of motion for the metric are actually the T vanishes. So the states of a string will be the states of this two-dimensional quantum field theory with the property that the stress tensor vanishes on them. Classically, we'll have to understand how to impose this quantum mechanically. This is similar to, I don't know how much you've done the quantization of the electromagnetic field, but at some point probably you'll encounter a situation where you had to impose gauge invariance on your states. So setting T equal to zero and acting on a state in the proper sense is imposing gauge invariance of the original string theory action. So that's why we need to keep track of the stress tensor in detail, not just because it's useful for understanding the two-dimensional quantum field theory. Now, at this point, usually, people describe something called the Virasoro algebra. So I define these modes, these are quantum mechanical modes acting on the states. You can wonder what's the algebra of these modes, what's their commutation relations. Perhaps before doing that, it's also useful to sort of understand how these modes act on my space. So just using this definition, what do we learn? Well, L0 and L0 bar essentially measure the energy of states, roughly. So you find that L0p is p squared over 2p. This begins to answer the question that the guys asked at the beginning of the lecture, what's the energy of a state of momentum p? The energy is L0 plus L0 bar. So you're going to get p squared minus 1 over 12, keeping the Casimir energy into account. The modes with positive labels try to raise to lower the energy, so annihilate the ground states. And the modes with negative L build up on these ground states by bilinears. So for example, if you acted L minus 1 on this state, you obtain this, perhaps plus a multiple of this. Something like P times this plus this, and so on. In the same way, you can also do calculations like asking, oh, what's P, L minus L1, L minus 1, P prime. In principle, you can do this calculation just by plugging in the definition and using the oscillators. Now, do I have a free blackboard somewhere? So let's start by computing this. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Usually we say P zero zero compound would be an energy density. The mm-hmm. zero zero compound is stress density.
Yes.
But here we change a variable to and call T as a TSS, right?
Yes.
Can we still say that that is the energy density?
No, it's TSS plus TSS bar plus TSS bar, roughly. So the energy is L zero. So now if the total energy, which is the integral over space, turns out to be the zero mod of T plus the zero mod of T bar. So you get L zero plus L zero bar minus 112. The momentum is the difference between L zero and L zero bar, the momentum on the worksheet. So maybe I can write it here. I might be missing some factors of 2 or pi or whatever. But roughly, for example, the state P has zero momentum and energy P squared. The state A minus 1 P has energy P squared plus 1. Okay, always minus 112, doesn't matter. And momentum 1. Because I've turned on a left mover on top of my ground state, so I get momentum in some direction. If I have A minus 1, A1 minus 1 bar, has zero momentum because I turned on one unit of left moving excitation and one unit of right moving excitation, so on and so forth. Now, this calculation is pretty easy. You can just use the definition. My A is going to catch only one of these, 2. You get something like that. Now I would like to also compute the commutator between two L's. But if I do it by hand using this expression, I encounter again some kind of zeta function regularization issue. I don't like it. So I'll do it in a painful way. I'll first compute this commutator. Essentially, I'll go back to the point splitting definition. And in the meanwhile, I'll also learn a few useful things. So this is the first useful thing I want to learn. See, L acts on fields. How does it act? Well, notice that, let me just erase the derivative for a moment, for convenience. See that L is acting on the scalar field as a diffeomorphism, as a coordinate, an infinitesimal coordinate transformation, which is redefining S as S plus e to the ns. So this is the concrete realization of the fact I mentioned that the modes of the stress tensor generate this infinite symmetry of redefining your holomorphic coordinates. And now, of course, you can keep going. You can compute ln with ds, x of s, ds prime, x of s prime, It's all in the notes. And you can take the point splitting definition of the stress tensor. You learn that Ln acts on the stress tensor in a pretty interesting way. So here's something interesting is happening. If I just look classically how diffeomorphism acts on the stress tensor, I would not get this and I would not get this. So something strange is happening to the transformation of the stress tensor under a diffeomorphism. Actually, this is actually not a diffeomorphism. This is a crucial point. A diffeomorphism changes the metric, right? When if I change S to S plus epsilon e to the ns, definitely my metric will change. But I can bring it back to the flat metric with a wild transformation. So these modes here actually are implementing a combination of diffeomorphisms and wild transformation, which brings the metric back to the flat metric. So this is telling you how T is transforming under this combination of diffeomorphism and wild transformation. T is surely diffeomorphism invariant. So these extra pieces we are getting must be coming from the wild transformations. So these are the way the wild anomaly manifests itself in T. In particular, the number that appears here tells you the magnitude of the wild anomaly is the central charge I was mentioning before. If you redo this calculation in a generic two-dimensional theory, here you'll find C over 12, where C is the central charge. Central charge is normalized conventionally in such a way that free boson has C equal to 1, just because of the simpler theory we can consider. OK, so now I can just expand in Fourier mode, and I get to the final answer. This is the Virasoro algebra. So it's called the central extension of the algebra of holomorphic vector fields. So if you ignore this correction, this is just the algebra of transformations of this sort. But there is an extra constant term, extra term proportional to a C number. But this is so-called central extension. Central extensions are critical whenever you have problems with the measure of your path integral. In the sense, it's the fact that the measure gets multiplied by something under a transformation, turns out to give x, means that potentially the transformations of the measure might close up to some number. Yes?
Shouldn't this last term be proportional to the central charge?
Yes, but for the free boson, the central charge is 1. So this is the relation in the context of a free boson. It's correct. In general, there will be an arbitrary constant here, which is the value of the central extension. Now, when you say that this is a central extension, this is actually, I think, the central extension of the Virasoro algebra, meaning you can ask yourself, what's the most general thing that I can put here, which is a number? And you'll find that after redefining your generators, you can always bring it down to this form. So it's sort of a toy model of that, of the statement that you can always bring the oval anomaly to some canonical form by redefinitions of the metric, although you cannot eliminate it. Okay, so this is how the Virasoro algebra comes about. Tomorrow we'll move on to the string spectrum. Any final questions? We're kind of late. So maybe I'll take questions at the beginning of next lecture.